Shrink Wrap Radio number 44, July 28, 2006, The DNA of Leadership. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Well, now we know that 50% of our DNA, our genes, are coded, encoded to be influenced by the environment. That means that they intentionally are encoded to be changed by how things impact them. If you hold that in front of you as a leader, it changes dramatically how we lead, how we think about others, how we influence, how we bring out the potential in others. Because what it suggests is that we can influence how people act and behave and grow based on how the environment impacts them, and the code is on how people feel when they're interacting with others. We don't remember often what they say or what they did, but we really remember how people make us feel.
That was the voice of Judith E. Glaser, an innovative and pioneering change agent and executive coach. She considers herself an organizational anthropologist working with clients at the intersection of culture, leadership, and brand. In 1980, she founded Benchmark Communications in New York City, a firm that works with CEOs and their teams, helping them focus on competitive challenges in a world of moving targets. She has two books. The first is called Creating We, Change I Thinking to We Thinking, and Build a Healthy, Thriving Organization. And her latest book is called The DNA of Leadership. Both of these books made Amazon Business Book bestseller lists in 2005 and 2006, and were also selected by both Forbes and Business Book Review as two of the top books of 2005 in 2006. She's made many television and radio appearances, and she is a frequent guest speaker. She's also contributing editor of Executive Excellence magazine and is listed in the Excellence 100 consultants. Some of the firms that she has consulted to include Merrill Lynch, Siemens, Pfizer, Coach, Lipton, VeriSign, Thomson, Novartis, Verizon, Citibank, Donna Karan International, and Clairol. Finally, she was also a founding member of the Executive Women's Business Forum. She was awarded Businesswoman of the Year in New York City in 2004. So without further ado, we go to our interview with Judith Glaser. Hi, Judith. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
I'm glad to be here.
Good. First off, I want to mention that I was introduced to your work and your book, The DNA of Leadership, by Stephen Cotterill in the UK. He's a regular listener to this program, and after some email exchanges between us, I realized he would be a good guest, and I did an interview with him, and then he turned me on to you.
Wow. He's a genius. He's just an incredible guy. I've never met anybody who networks the way he does and really brings people together and tries to develop ideas with others. He's quite amazing.
Yeah, he really is a network. It's the whole 6 degrees of separation thing. And another point of contact between you and me is I see that you have some connection with the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. It's a tenuous connection, but I did my undergraduate work at Penn many years ago.
It's an excellent school. Yeah. My son actually was there as well getting his degree.
All right.
And every time I go back there, I just realize what they've done to create such a thriving environment.
Right.
Not only when you're there, but after you leave.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, I wasn't interested in business when I was there, so I missed out on the whole Wharton experience, and it's only subsequently that I've learned what a prestigious place the Wharton School is.
Mm-hmm.
Judith, this show is about people who work in and around the broad field of psychology, and I've been researching your background a bit, and I see that your master's degree is in human behavior and development, so I'm guessing that program would have had a fair amount of psychology. Is that
right?
Well,
interestingly enough, my undergraduate was also in psychology.
Oh, okay. Okay,
so, and I, at the time, I tried to create an experience that was what you call interdisciplinary.
Yeah.
Where I was trying to do the intersection of psychology with all sorts of other things, everything from sociology to physiology to philosophy, everything that anthropology, so that the heart of what makes us human becomes emergent and much more clear.
Oh, very good, very good. Okay, now you head up a major business consulting firm in New York City. To what extent has your earlier exposure to psychology and the study of human behavior influenced your consulting work?
It's funny you should ask that. I just, on Friday, was a keynoter at Temple University, where I did get my undergraduate, and I started my talk really focusing on how my education set into place the pillars of my thinking.
Uh-huh.
And so I really truly believe that the exposure that I had to some state-of-the-art thinkers and people who were radically pushing the envelope, even at the time, around psychology and the intersection. Anthropology was one of my favorite subjects because it really got us into not only what human beings are, but human beings in culture and what that means to create norms, which, of course, has led me into the kind of work that I do with companies now.
Right, right. Yeah, cultural anthropology was one of my favorite classes when I was in graduate school. Well, let's talk about your latest book, The DNA of Leadership. Why DNA? Do you really think there's a leadership gene, or is this more of a metaphor?
No, I when I started out, I was very influenced by my husband's work. He is working in a small research and development company that has uncovered a new cure for cancer. And this cure is at the genetic level. It's a natural peptide, that his team has uncovered, which when injected in and around cancer cells or bodies that have cancer in them, goes to target some messaging system inside the RNA and DNA to remind the cells how to be normal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love the metaphor, but I also truly believe that we're at a time in history right now where we are embarking on truly uncovering what the power of DNA is in our lives. And there's enough research that's surfacing now to make this metaphor actually come alive and have meaning in real terms. And I can talk more about that.
Okay, and I will invite you to talk more about that as it feels appropriate as we go along. One of the things I noticed right away in your book is your repeated use of the word conversations. You seem to be saying that the health of an organization depends very much on the sorts of conversations that are taking place, and that a measure of leadership is the sorts of conversations the leader is able to engender. Can you expand on this? Why so much focus on conversations?
I think we've spent so much time in teaching people about what leadership is about, management is about, in focusing on analytical measures of people's leadership abilities or competencies, and that we've fallen into the trap of saying that you're born with certain competencies, and we use language like, these are your strengths, and then, of course, you have weaknesses, and now there's questions about whether people should focus on weaknesses or strengths. And from my standpoint, we're getting caught up in the semantics of leadership when we focus so much attention on the labels that we put people and the permanency of certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And so my research into genetics has uncovered that only 50% of our genes are fixed. Where we used to think 100% were fixed, because we see on TV CSI and all these programs about finding people that are dead and uncovering DNA, and then all of a sudden catching this criminal who's still running around the world.
Right.
And right, that's based on DNA being fixed and not eroding over time.
Oh.
Well, now we know that 50% of our DNA, our genes, are coded, encoded to be influenced by the environment. That means that they intentionally are encoded to be changed by how things impact them. If you hold that in front of you as a leader, it changes dramatically how we lead, how we think about others, how we influence, how we bring out the potential in others. Because what it suggests is that we can influence how people act and behave and grow based on how the environment impacts them, and the code is on how people feel when they're interacting with others. We don't remember often what they say or what they did, but we really remember how people make us feel.
Okay.
And that comes through conversations.
Uh-huh.
So leaders understand that conversations are, there's actually a genetic structure that says that that when we say it's encoded by the environment, that gets influenced by the environment, language and conversations impact us so dramatically as human beings that it helps shape our genetic code and what we pass on to the next generation.
So what conversations are you thinking of when you use the term? Are you talking about the sort of casual conversations that people are having around the water cooler, or are you talking about the official communications that, you know, come from the leaders in the organization?
I actually want leaders to be alerted or aware of the fact that what they consider to be casual conversations or the gossip that we have by the water cooler, mm-hmm. that gossip and gossip conversations are often what people do to support each other in the effort to understand what's really going on inside of a company. And so these are not casual conversations. These are the conversations where people strike out and learn from each other who's a friend mm-hmm. and who's a foe, mm-hmm. and who are we going to dish and who are we going to support. Mm-hmm. That those are not, gossip doesn't mean that, or casual doesn't mean it's not powerful. In fact, in many organizations, the gossip and the informal conversations are more powerful than what leaders have to say when they're out publicly using
right.
their PowerPoints.
Right, right. So as a consultant, how do you tap into that? How do you intervene in the conversations that are going on?
What I try to do is bring the public, I try to bring the public and the private conversations together in one. When organizations and people are afraid of what's really happening in the company and they're too politicized, then this gossip mill becomes their source of strength and understanding of how to deal with what's going on. And it is often the place where the most raw conversations also take place, mm-hmm. where people share their real feelings with others and hope in secrecy that they can gain the confidence of someone to help them pursue some difficult challenge. Those are the kind of conversations that we need to bring into the public domain, because resident inside of those conversations are the real challenges that people face in not only working with each other, but dealing with the challenges in the marketplace. And once they become more public and once people learn how to deal with them in a constructive way, then we don't have these two conversations competing for mind share and heart share of people.
Right, right. Okay. Your book's organized around an acronym, which I found interesting, and the acronym refers to the seven qualities or genes, to use your metaphor, that you see as essential to great leadership. And the acronym is CHANGES. Please take us through what each of the seven letters in CHANGES refers to and why they matter.
Well, let me tell you the bigger picture, and then we can go back to how the book is organized. And the
okay.
bigger picture is that human beings need to be included. They need to be part of a winning team. And in fact, that's what people use as their metronome for whether they are being successful or not successful in the company. And so inclusion is the most important element for mm-hmm. human beings. In fact, I created a term when I was writing both of my books called vital instincts. Rather than just territorial instincts that talk about what we often see as the fighting and competing to win, that I believe that what we have are vital instincts, which is that need to be connected and bond with others.
Mm-hmm.
And when that bond is disconnected or cut or severed, or when people feel excluded, that's when we resort to the kind of behavior we call territorial, mm-hmm. because we're fighting to be included again.
Right.
And so if we're not included in the right team, then we create our own team. That's how gangs occur. That's how gangs get created.
Right.
Right? So the whole thing is built on a model of inclusion, not exclusion.
Okay.
And each one of the dimensions deal with that in some way. People want to be respected and appreciated, not judged, which is the second gene. People want to be able to have their dreams and hopes come to play in the marketplace, in their business, in their life. We don't, you know, we go to bed thinking about what you want next. That's your dream. And what people get motivated by is realizing their dreams. That's the third gene.
Okay, I'm not sure I caught the first one. What was the first?
The first one is inclusion. I'm sorry. But, is the bigger one of this, kind of the armature of all of this, is the ability to be included on a winning team, to be co-creating with others. It's that need to be in a community. In other words, when you're in a community, you're being taken care of by others.
Okay, so community is the first.
Is the first one.
Is the first one in that's going to spell changes as we go down
Correct.
With the first letter. So C is for
exactly.
community.
Right.
And
the
H.
The second one is humanity. We have to be in a place where we are humanly treated. And so being appreciated, not being judged unfairly, is the H gene.
Okay, I can
relate
to that.
And the H gene is aspirations. Aspirations mean to aspire. Aspire means to breathe life into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can focus on our dreams, it, you know, the old idea of talking about your vision, a company's vision is about the aspiration of the company.
Okay.
Well, human beings need to be in that conversation with each other, not just about the corporate vision, but their personal aspirations. That's so critical.
Definitely.
Right. N is navigating, and when we navigate together and we share roles, we share responsibilities, we share resources, we share information, that sharing element is so critical for people to be effective in a community. Withholding causes people to feel political with each other. So learning how to share and navigate together, navigate and share power is
right.
So critical. Generativity is about, we get often caught in stuck in the way things are now, whether it's status quo, whether it's our own ego, whether it's not changing because what's good is good, so let's not move on. That generativity is a human need to grow. It's a human need to change. When you take that away from people, they feel they stagnate.
Right.
So generativity is critical.
Mm-hmm.
Expression, having a voice. Human beings, our DNA is made to be different from somebody else's. Each DNA has a voice. Environments have to enable the development of a voice, not the dictating of one leadership authority voice. Environments need to be created to enable the voice to speak, individuals' voices to speak. And S is a, I call it spirit, or the synchronizing of human beings towards a shared purpose. And we need to be rewarded for every step we take moving forward, the milestones we create, the lessons we learn from working together. And so building spirit and purpose into our life is a human need. It's an absolute
yeah.
human need. When people lose purpose, they die.
That's true.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the whole armature of the DNA model is built on what I call the leadership gene,
mm-hmm.
which has in it, or the DNA of leadership, which has in it, the elements that human beings need to thrive together. And when we create environments that honor those elements, everything shifts. Everything becomes that good feeling of
right.
wanting to be at work every day.
Right. You know, I'm really struck by the degree to which what you've outlined resonates with, well, what I would call humanistic transpersonal psychology, which is where my own psychological background and allegiance lies. I'm thinking of people like Abraham Maslow, Carl Rogers, Sidney Gerrard, who wrote The Transparent Self, among others. And I'm wondering to what extent you've either consciously or unconsciously been influenced by the humanistic transpersonal psychology movement.
I'm actually going to stretch it out a little bit bigger for you, which is that from the beginning of my work, I had this incredible belief that there's a universality about our humanity that is not being recognized. And once you start to overlay disciplines like transpersonal psychology, if you overlay that, and I've studied the chakras, you overlay the chakras,
mm-hmm.
I've studied feng shui, if you overlay feng shui, integral, you know, the whole integral movement.
Yes.
All of these, if you overlay them, are speaking about the same dramatic, human, universal impulses that we have, the vital instincts that enable us to grow and thrive and evolve together. They're not different. They're very similar. I've studied McKinsey's work. I've studied so many different theoreticians and consultants and philosophers.
Yes, right.
It sits on top of, it's like the armature. It's like the spine. And once we start to acknowledge that these are all saying the same thing, we as leaders need to encode and decode these messages and simplify it so that we can all begin to resonate towards these natural forces, which are both inside of us and outside of us.
I couldn't agree with you more. And that's really a lot of what this whole series is about, is, you know, as we look into different approaches to psychology and different ways that people implement it, I really see so many commonalities relating to the kinds of issues that you've brought up here in your book. And it's wonderful to see somebody articulating them so, ideals and values relating to human behavior, you know, things like bonding and spirit and all the other things that you know, humanizing and aspiring, being a generative. You know, I'm so glad that there are people like you who champion this in the business world.
Well, one of the things, I had an amazing experience in 1986. I played a very large role as the managing editor and major contributor for a dictionary for Random House. And it was a new business dictionary.
Uh-huh.
We had to come up with 3,500 new business terms. And the words that you described, the words that I've used, I selected them carefully and intentionally because I felt that language influences the way we see the world.
Definitely.
And either we need to redefine the words that we use to enable new things to be birthed in the world, or we need to create new words to enable things to be birthed.
Mm-hmm.
And so words like leadership, if you look in the dictionary, they are much more about command and control, at least in the old definition. If you look at the word collaboration, which we so heartily use in business today, that word actually means cohorting with the enemy. And so much of our thinking is built on that competitive model of,
yes,
may the best gene win.
Right, right.
And I think a lot of us now, you are doing this in your program, I'm doing this, the people that I love to work with are trying to bring people together and say, it's not the I against the we, and it's not the I against the I, it's the I inside of the we that needs to be nurtured. And once you start thinking in a different frame of reference,
mm-hmm,
you start using new language, so that people don't, then you change the way people can operate with each other. We experience each other differently.
Nicely put. I know that people in organization development have, you know, for many years been influenced by Maslow and other humanistic thinkers and have really worked hard to kind of push business more in the direction that you're talking about of thinking in terms of we rather than mm-hmm. a highly competitive model in which everybody's competing against everybody all the time. How successful do you think this movement has been so far? You know, I'm just, do you have any sense of the percentage of businesses that now think this way?
I think it's in the past, the movement, the Maslow movement and things like that were a counter movement to something else.
Yeah.
Right, and so there's the swing between the soft and the hard.
Right.
Right, and I think what's different now is that, at least certainly the way I'm trying to bring it into the world, that it's the hard and the soft are coming together. The I and the we are coming
mm-hmm.
together. These are not pendulum swings that you see in history, that it's a different way to frame it up, and therefore the result will be different.
Yeah, I think you're right, you know. I've kind of, me and my colleagues have sort of struggled with the term humanistic psychology, which as a movement, it's just about disappeared. And I think the reason why it's disappeared is because it's been absorbed. A lot of what people were protesting against and so on is now taken for granted. And it's kind of been absorbed into the culture at large. Would you agree with that?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
I do. And I just think, I mean, the more and more I see different dichotomies being looked upon as just different parts of a continuum. I mean, even the male and female are just part of a larger continuum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the passive and aggressive, all these kinds of things are words that we use to try to describe this amazing energy and forces that are going on around us. And once we get smarter about the linguistic nature of the complexes that we deal with, the better we are able to not get caught up in the dynamic tensions, but we're able to step up above them.
Right.
I don't know if I'm making sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It certainly makes sense to me, and I suspect to a large portion of my audience. You know, as I'm leafing through your book here, I'm remembering that you've got lots of little quizzes and ways to help a person score themselves and so that they have some idea of how they're doing on some of these dimensions that you're talking about. And
uh-huh.
for 7 years, I was the chair of the psychology department at Sonoma State University. So I was in a position of leadership. And so, you know, as I was reading through this book, I couldn't help but be evaluating myself as I went along. And I love your scales. Let me just kind of randomly choosing a page here
uh-huh.
Under the topic of spirit and culture of reinvention, and you have statements in which people are asked to rate themselves along lines of 1 equals never and 7 equals always, and you've got statements like, I celebrate accomplishments, recognizing people regardless of level or profile. I inspire enthusiasm and loyalty to the company and brand. I help people to learn to recognize and achieve milestones. enable people to see how their efforts connect to the organizational goals. And it goes on, and you have lots and lots of scales like this. And just reading the scales are very provocative in terms of stimulating, you know, certainly they stimulated my own thought and self-examination, you know, even though I didn't circle. I didn't actually give myself the grades, but...
Right. But well, that's what I hope. And I think you've really nailed something that's important to this whole process and to how I created my work, which is that when you get to ask reflective questions about the frequency that you do something or the quality within which you do something, it seems to awaken the mind.
Mm-hmm.
It puts attention to something that you may not have done before.
Yes.
And it actually creates a vision into which you can step and explore and experiment.
Right.
And that's part of my hope. I wanted to use, as you called it, provocative
mm-hmm.
thoughts
mm-hmm.
that really have a lot of that we-centric energy to them.
Great.
As a way to really stimulate people to begin to open up. So much of coaching is about self-awareness.
Yeah, yeah.
If people do nothing more than read the first chapter and say, you know, let me dream on this tonight. Hopefully the next day they will be much more conscious of their interactions with others.
Yeah, you mentioned coaching, and that's something that's come up previously on this show as we examine, you know, various career options. How do you classify your business consulting at this point? Is it coaching, or is it organization development, or, you know, how would you describe your niche?
My niche is different than all those. I tried to create something that speaks to my soul, and pretty much in the same way with it when I created my company's name. It spoke to my soul. And so Benchmark Communications was a name I used because it was about uncovering or understanding. Benchmark means the state of excellence. It's the highest standard
mm-hmm.
against which we compare ourselves. And I wanted to study people and organizations and teams in terms of their communication so I could better understand what the best are doing, to capture and understand the best practices or to share them, but even define them. What does best look like?
Okay.
And so my approach is, the word for me is, I'm an organizational anthropologist.
Uh-huh.
And that gives me the liberty to not only work on, it's at the intersection of culture, leadership, and brand. And I didn't want to be limited to just organization development. I didn't want to be just limited to human resources. You know, I wanted to be at the intersection of where all these dynamics are coming to play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, some portion of our audience is students, and I'm wondering what advice you would offer to students who might want to get into doing the sort of consulting work that you do. For example, can they do it with a focus in psychology, or do they have to major in business, or, you know, what's your recommendation to the young person today who wants to make a difference in business?
Part of, I think we all have to be able to have talks with ourselves and try to figure out inside what our thrust is. Is our thrust toward, do we want to be in business or education? You know, where do we like to, where, if we could wake up every day and have our dreams come true, to really be honest with ourselves mm-hmm. about the people we want to be surrounded with and the types of challenges that motivate us. Most students also have to understand that wherever they start is a starting place, and most likely they're going to be evolving because their learning evolves, their
right.
wisdom evolves, their sense of self and where their talents and skills can be best applied also evolves, and new strengths often develop over time, and so who they are today isn't necessarily who they ultimately will become. So they have to give themselves a little slack for that, the learning that takes place, the self-discovery that takes place.
Yeah,
but I think the big thing is you're leaning more towards the business arena or towards education.
Yeah.
And if it's then, once you make those decisions, what fascinates you? What is the passion
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
you have? If you could having conversations every day with people about certain subjects, what do you think would be that? And even if you can't answer it, to allow yourself to have that be something that evolves in your consciousness so that you end up being where you love to be, even during your educational process.
Great advice, and you're a great role model for that, having followed, as you described, a very kind of interdisciplinary approach to your own education in order to find your own bliss.
That's the words I want to use, Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, right, Joseph Campbell.
Follow your bliss.
Exactly.
And I know what's interesting at Temple is that they now have a program in interdisciplinary studies.
Uh-huh.
So it's emerging. A lot of times, if we become pioneers in our own life, very often we're going to be following this bliss or this instinct that we have about where we need to be, what's right for us. And sometimes that takes us outside of where the norm is and puts us on the edge of the provocative new.
Right.
And you're doing that in your program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I want people to understand that that's okay if you go there, to stay with your bliss, to stay with your passion, to stay with the things that, that fascinate you, because out of that, you will start to connect dots of things that previously were never connected. And out of that, you will discover what your personal contribution is going to be to the planet if you follow that bliss.
Right, right. Now, but, you know, challenges come along, and you've built up a very successful consulting practice with very high-profile clients. What was the biggest challenge you faced in doing this, and how did you overcome it?
I remember early along in my career, I had children and had to make a choice about work-at-home mom, work-outside-of-home mom, all those kinds of things. And I wanted to work, and so I had to negotiate with my kids that we would bring other people to help and that I would spend time at their school, but I had to be doing this, otherwise I wouldn't be happy, and if I wasn't happy, they wouldn't be happy. So that was early along. And then I started to, again, I'm such an intuiter about where I need to be. I met some people early along at, believe it or not, a video store, and it was somebody, I was studying video production on top of all the other things I studied. I'm a video producer. And I had a conversation with somebody at the video store at a company called U.S. Tobacco in Connecticut, and I was working with companies close by, and he said, come in and see me, and I did. I went in and saw him, and we had conversations about, again, where my field fits into his field and what I was trying to do and he was trying to do, and he ultimately said to me, hey, listen, you're a female, and we don't hire female consultants.
Oh, great.
And he said, thanks for talking to me. I'm really glad that we have a lot in common, but, you know, this is going to be a go-nowhere conversation. I remember saying to myself, do not let stereotypes get in the way of your success. I talked to myself about that. And I said, I'm going to go after this business anyway, in spite of what this guy said. And so I think that's been one of the bigger things in my life, that I've tried to break through things that were either stereotypes or judgments about my capability, about my experience. It may sound, you know, I can look back now and see that it's brought me great clients, so I know that it's helped. At the time, sometimes it took a lot more courage than I ever knew whether I'd have inside. But again, it's that story of staying with your bliss and staying with your what you believe is right and good. And even if you get knocked over, find a way to get back on the horse again.
That's a great place for us to close. I'm going to put a link to your book in the show notes. I'm wondering if there's another book you'd recommend that's had a big impact on your personal life or on your career.
On me personally?
Yeah.
I think it's the work of Joseph Campbell that's had, you know, collectively had one of the bigger impacts on me. There's also a book named by Alfred Korzybski, who was one of the pioneers of general semantics, and it's a very old book, very old book. But it's where I really learned the most important lessons that I use in my work continually today, which is about that the map is not the territory. What you have in your head is not what's going on outside of you. And so language is really how we create our world. And while that's an old book, if you look up Alfred Korzybski, you'll find the link, you know, what his book is all about.
Right.
It's that type of thinker that I continue to follow, like Gladwell Today with Blink.
Yes.
Something that takes us, you know, out of the ordinary and introduces a new word or a new concept that really shifts us in the way we look at the world.
Judith, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been my treat. You're asking me very provocative questions, and it's given me a chance to, as I sit back, to even think about things that I had not valued that I'm now going to revalue in the way I look at the world. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Judith Glaser. It's wonderful to hear that there are humanizing influences at work in the world of business. I'm glad that there are consultants like Judith out there bringing the light of a humane interpersonal approach to the corporate world. This certainly wasn't the case when I was in college. For a number of years now, I've run a successful market research business of my own. You can check it out at e-focusgroups.com. But if you had told me I would ever be interested in business when I was an undergraduate, or even in graduate school, I would have told you that you were crazy. Rather than following up Judith's interview with my own sober treatise on business, I think I'll let my hair down a bit, relax my persona of the mighty Oz, and share a story with you from one of my first forays into the world of business. Journey back in time with me to yesteryear at the University of Pennsylvania. Picture me fresh out of college with a sparkling new diploma in creative writing. It doesn't take me long to realize I will quickly starve to death writing the great American novel, so I hightail it down to the local employment office to see if they can find me a job. As luck would have it, there's an opening for an advertising copywriter for Strawbridge and Clothier, a chain of department stores in Philadelphia. A perfect start for honing the talents of a creative writer such as myself. Before I know it, I'm in my own cubicle, turning out memorable, almost poetic prose along the lines of "Pantyhose Sale, One Day Only, Two for the Price of One." Now, to the uninitiated, this might sound easy, but they would be mistaken, for the advertising copywriter faces the daunting challenge of cramming the maximum amount of information in the most compelling way into a headline that will admit only a certain number of letters. Though young in years at the time, I do not shrink from such a challenge. Thus, when Mr. Fisher, who is referred to deferentially in our store as the head of the advertising pyramid, comes into my office with a face flushed red with excitement, I can only assume he's come to tell me I've won an award of some sort. "Did you write this headline?" he thunders, holding out a page from the Philadelphia Inquirer. His beet red face looks like it might explode at any moment. "Why, yes, I did," I say with pride. "Do you know what this means?" he asks incredulously. It turns out I've written a headline meaning something I have not intended. The headline, which greeted 5 million readers of the Philadelphia Inquirer as they pored over their morning paper, is as follows: "New Boy's Jacket Breaks Wind." Having been raised in a sheltered religious environment, I am blissfully and naively unaware that the colloquial phrase "to break wind" means to pass gas. I was merely looking for a compact and impactful way to advertise windbreaker jackets. A week or two later, I'm called into a meeting with the advertising managers. I'm pretty certain they are about to fire me. Fortunately, I've just heard that I've been accepted into a master's program in psychology at the University of Montana. So I go into the meeting, and before anyone else has a chance to speak, I say, "I'm glad we have a chance to get together. I've just received an offer to go to graduate school, and unless you can pay me a lot more money, I'm afraid I'm going to need to resign." Thankfully, they very graciously reply, "Gee, we hate to lose you, but the budget is tight, and we think you should take advantage of the chance to go to graduate school." And that, boys and girls, is how the world of business lost a great ad man and psychology gained a Dr. Dave.
The great and mighty Oz has spoken.
Oz has spoken. Oz has spoken.
Oz has spoken.
Oz has spoken. You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hey Hey, I felt like having a bit of fun during that last segment. I hope you enjoyed it too. Let me run an idea by you. I've been thinking of possibly doing a really short daily show in addition to Shrink Wrap Radio. What do you think of that idea? I've thought of calling it the Shrink Wrap Radio Daily House Call, or Dr. Dave's Daily House Call, or the Shrink Wrap Radio Minute. But what would the content be? Well, I've got two ideas. One would be to read a sentence or two from Jung or some other book I'm reading, and then give a short reaction to it or explication of it. Another idea is to quickly summarize some piece of psychological research. Maybe you've got some good ideas for me. I'd love to hear them. Is this even something you'd want to subscribe to? Let me know. To shift gears just a notch, if you're thinking of getting a domain name, you can use my discount code of SHRINK3 at checkout on GoDaddy.com and get it for $6.95 for a year instead of the usual $8.95. Also, you can win a free autographed copy of the book I co-authored, in which I do a psychological profile of the infamous Zodiac serial killer. All you have to do is put yourself on our Frapper map by going to frappr.com/shrinkwrapradio, or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's what the following people did, and you can do it too. I'm talking about Michael Z. in Bowling Green, Kentucky, Mitchell F. in Brunswick, Lower Saxony, Germany, Karsten S. in San Francisco, Lauren in Nashville, Tennessee, and Joshua in Anacortes, Washington. Also, drop me an email if you're at all interested in attending the workshop I'll be co-leading in Tuscany, Italy, from September 18 to the 24th.
This is Josh C. from San Jose. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Way to go, Josh. Now that's what I'm talking about. I'd sure like to see more of you record a little transition like that and send it to me. You can do it right on our site using MyChingo, just like Josh did. Or you can send me an MP3 or leave it as a message on Skype. I'm looking for some more of these MyChingo messages. All you need is a microphone hooked up to your computer. There's no cost to you or to me, and sharing your voice is a great way to build community. You'll see a bright green MyChingo logo on the left side of each of the Shrink Wrap Radio pages. Just click on that and the rest will be clear. You can record a comment or a question, or you can record one of those little transitions I like to use, along the lines of, "Hi, this is Juan from Juarez, Mexico, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave. Speaking of Juarez, Mexico, I still haven't heard from a single listener in Mexico or South America. If you are south of the border, please add yourself to our Frapper map, and let's hear from you." Now, on to some of our listener mail. First, we hear from Dennis W., who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, first let me say how your show was a synchronistic answer to my prayers when I found it online. It was during a point where I really felt like I had no direction to my life, and due to all the walls in front of me, I was seriously beginning to believe that I had invested all of my time and energy into a career path that I wanted to leave. I started my interest in psychology in my junior year of high school because I found the topic to be interesting, and I was the only person in my class that year who had a real aptitude for the discipline. I found my way into a psychology program at a small liberal arts college in the Midwest and began to lose interest in the topic because my classes began to turn further and further away from the psychoanalytic topics that interested me towards a doldrum of quantitative analysis. I studied for a year in England, which picked up my interest a bit, but upon my return, I was faced with the same dilemma that I thought I had left behind. It was at this time that I was lacking in electives and decided to take a social psychology course in the sociology department. I thought it would be relatively simple to pass since I had already took a similar course in psychology. I was right, it was easy, but it had nothing to do with my previous experience and everything to do with my fascination with the topic presented from this angle. Mead, Goffman, Berger, and Mills reconstructed the way I thought. Sociology had started to answer questions that I had been ruminating in my mind over the past 4 years, and I had to keep my pursuit of this topic up, especially regarding the areas concerned with mental health and gender. I decided to take a double major, and I crammed the courses in over my last year. I applied to graduate school and was accepted to a program in Chicago. I began to fall into disillusionment again at about the time I was getting ready to receive my MA. The main reason behind this was because I loved the material I was learning, but I yearned to work in a clinical setting, which can be tough for a sociologist. I obtained a job in a psychiatric nursing facility and decided that this was the career path I wanted. Realizing this, I took a leave of absence from my program to work for a year and make some decisions. I decided to attempt getting into a psychology PhD program, which I had no luck in. I was feeling pretty down when I stumbled on your show. I was intrigued by your discussions about Jungian psychology, and I have found your more practical topics, such as your show on police psychology, to be very germane to my work. It reinvigorated my desire and fascination with the subject, as well as reasserting my confidence in myself, and I decided that I was going to find a way to make things work. Opportunity has knocked since that time, and I'm now the director of social services for a long-term care facility, for which I'm currently in the process of designing and implementing a psychiatric rehabilitation program for a new unit. I am also slated to start classes in the fall so that I can obtain my PhD in sociology. I've decided to pursue my two main topics of interest, mental health and gender. I'm also slated to take my CADC exam this winter, and I have hopes of getting my LPC license after the next 3 years of clinical supervision. My current goal is to learn more about the field of sociotherapy so that I may eventually be licensed. This concept is still very new to me, and I was wondering if it would be possible for you to find a guest who could speak about the topic. Sorry for running on a bit, but I wanted to give you a good idea of where I've been and where I'm going so you can see how important your show and guests have been in my life. Thank you again, Dr. Dave. Dennis. Well, Dennis, sociotherapy is a new concept for me, too, but I will keep my ear to the ground for a possible guest in that area. And I thank you for writing such a detailed letter and wish you all the best in your career as it continues to unfold. I've been having a bit of private correspondence with Cody, who is in Israel, and since much of her email is very personal, I won't share it, but I do want to share with you the place where she says, "I don't know if you noticed, but some weeks now, there's a real war here in Israel. It is scary, very scary. And you know, doesn't matter that there is a war going on, life goes on also. People have to go to work where and when there is no battle." So Cody, all of our wishes are with you and with others in that war-torn region, and we certainly hope that the war will stop soon, right away. Lauren writes to say that she'd like to hear more about the myths and beliefs that are perpetuated about AIDS, as well as their consequences. She writes that she has an aunt who died a few weeks ago from AIDS, and because of familial connection to the disease, it's always been a topic of interest. She was very interested in what my guest, Dr. Krippner, had to say on the subject, and she writes that she'd love to hear more. So, Lauren, I will keep my ear to the ground for a good guest on the topic of AIDS, and actually I might approach Dr. Stanley Krippner again and see if he would speak to that topic, because he is a great guest. And finally, I'll share one more from Chris C., who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Let's get the sycophantic bit out of the way. I love the podcast. Thank you. I only started listening a few weeks ago, and I'm already hooked. I have nothing to do with the world of psychology, apart from the fact that I have a healthy interest in the workings of the mind. I actually work in IT. The main part of my job involves traveling around the globe, setting up audiovisual equipment and IT requirements on stands at large exhibitions. It sounds glamorous, but in real terms, I get to see a lot of exhibition centers, hotel rooms, and airports. It's very rare that I get to see much of the places I visit, but I digress. Hearing you mention shamanism in your podcast brought to mind a book that I recently finished reading, Supernatural Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind by Graham Hancock. In it, Mr. Hancock explores the possibility that through the medium of trance states, whether induced by the use of hallucinogenic plants, fasting, prolonged dancing, meditation, etc., the person in the altered state actually visits an alternative reality that is intertwined with our own existence, but is tuned out by filters present in our normal state. I think I was trying to say pretty much the same thing in the last podcast. He draws some interesting and intriguing parallels with shamanic spirit journeys, the history of the little people, fairies, pixies, etc., visitations from the angels, and the more recent phenomena of alien abductions. On the way through the book, the history of the shaman is discussed along with the evolution of culture and religion. There's a lot of information handed to you, but it's done in such a way that it keeps you captivated enough to get through the more heavy chapters. The book does not end with any earth-shattering conclusions, and if anything, leaves the reader with more questions than when they started reading it, but nevertheless is an absolutely fascinating read from start to finish. I would even go so far as to suggest that Graham Hancock might make an excellent guest on your program for his insights into the shamanic experience and what actually occurs to the person who's in the altered state from both a physiological and psychological point of view. Gotta go. My boss is going to start wondering why I'm in Google Mail and not the company email system. Keep up the good work. Best regards, Chris C. Chris, thanks so much for the suggestion, and I'll keep an eye out for that book. You may be surprised that this show has come out so quickly on the heels of my last episode. Since I had been out of town on two different trips, I wanted to make up for lost time. Send your emails to shrinkwrapradio.com. There's now yet a new way to access Shrink Wrap Radio. You can do so by going to shrinkwrapradio.podshow.com. The Podshow site has a number of features designed to help you subscribe to your favorite podcasts, and I'll be telling you more about it as time goes on. Please help spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and colleagues. If you've got a podcast or blog, or you're on MySpace or have a LinkedIn page, how about giving us a link or a plug there? If you have any place where you can play our promo, you'll find a promo on our site. Last show, I asked for some more recommendations on iTunes, and I want to thank KaiSchmidt1610 for leaving one there. Thanks again to Judith Glazer for the interview on leadership. It's going to take real leadership to stop the war in the Middle East. With that in mind, we close with the PodSafe musical selection, People, Let's Stop the War, by Freedom People. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying,
it's all in your mind.
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 Ever since Genesis through the fall of ancient Rome, history repeats itself as we reap what we have sown. From the slaughter of the Indians and Hitler's Holocaust, dinosaurs to world wars and lives forever lost. Some may call that evolution or karmic retribution, yet we still create more new enemies. When there's a peaceful resolution on the brink of revolution, sing now or forever hold your peace. Everybody, everywhere, people, let's stop the war. People, let's stop the war. Everybody, say a prayer. People, let's stop the war. People, let's stop the war. Let's stop the war. People, let's stop the war. Media magicians weave their webs of deceit, while greedy politicians watch us marching in the street, sacrificing poor young soldiers, making evil men get rich, 'cause there's money in those war machines now. Ain't that a bitch? Everybody, everywhere, people, let's stop the war. People, let's stop the war. Everybody, say a prayer. People, let's stop the war. People, let's stop the war. People, let's stop the war. People, let's stop the war.
We gotta govern the government. Police the police. Teach the teachers. Preach the preachers. Everyone live in peace.
Everybody, say a prayer. People, let's stop the war. People, let's stop the war. Everybody, say a prayer. People, let's stop the war. People, let's stop the war.